Have you ever tried to do something good and only bad comes from it? There you are, trying your hardest to do the right thing and it just all turns to custard. This is what happens in the text with Mordecai. Mordecai does a good deed. He saves the king's life. And instead of receiving a reward, Haman is promoted and genocide is now on the table. Tries to do good, and it only results in evil. Where is God when bad things result, when Christians are trying to be good Christians, and all that happens is the world hates you and tries to destroy you? This reminded me of a situation that the Apostle Paul found himself in. You'll remember in our study in Philippians that there was a famine in the Judean church. The Jewish Christians, they had suffered from a famine, they were now impoverished, and so Paul thought, well, here is a great opportunity. Let's get the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians to come together in unity by getting the Gentile Christians to take the surplus of their material goods and giving it as a gift to the needy Jewish Christians. And then the Jewish Christians will open their hearts to the Gentile Christians, and we will live with no racism in our hearts, and we'll all live happily ever after. That was the dream. That was the hope. Paul was trying to break down the wall of division. So, Paul, what does he do? Works very hard. Goes to all the churches. Writes letters to all the churches. Collects the money. Gets representatives from all the churches. And finally, he heads off to Jerusalem. And here he is with this love gift, weighing down the purses of he and those who are with him. And what happens when he gets to Jerusalem? He gets dragged into a meeting and slapped over the wrist for speaking against the law. There is absolutely no mention of the gift or gratitude of the gift. In fact, all those Gentile representatives from the churches that he brought to Jerusalem, some of the Jews from those towns saw Paul in Jerusalem with those people, and what did they think? He took them into the temple. He took Gentiles into the temple. Hey, he took Gentiles into the temple. Riot breaks out. They try and kill Paul on the spot. The Romans have to intervene. He gets put in chains for the next couple of years because he has to appeal to Caesar to save his life. No good deed goes unpunished. That's what it can feel like sometimes. All you're trying to do is the right thing, and nothing good results from it. In fact, you even end up paying for it to some extent. Or think of Joseph. Joseph, we know, was sold by his brothers into slavery instead of murdered. He gets sold into Potiphar's house. But Potiphar's wife thinks that Joseph is a good-looking man and propositions him. And there she is begging him, and he has to leave his garments in her hand, and he runs away naked. And as a result, she falsely accuses him, and he ends up in prison. Here is a young man trying to do the right thing. A hard thing and the right thing. And all that happens is he ends up in prison. And there he is in prison. Some prisoners have some dreams and he helps to interpret them. And all he says is, just please remember me when you get out. And they don't remember him for ages. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it pays to be good. Sometimes it hurts to be the people of God. So today, as we consider the providence of God at work in Esther, we are reminded that our faithfulness to God, although not acknowledged by man, is seen by God and rewarded by God. On top of that, we will see that though man's plans against the church seem to prosper, God is over and through it all, bringing good not despite evil, but actually through the evil itself. Our text follows two plots, the plot against Ahasuerus and the plot against the Jews. And these will make up our 2 points. So let's read again verses 19 to 23. Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther. And Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When this affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Ahasuerus was a bad man, and people tried to assassinate him over and over again. In fact, he died by assassination. Ahasuerus would not stop sleeping with his generals' wives, and as a result, they took matters into their hands, and they ended up killing him. So that's how this man, his life eventually ended. Well, here is another assassination plot, and we don't know why. We're not told all of the details. Our section opens with an historical event, the second gathering of the virgins. It's not clear what this is, but it must have been known to the people at the time. Was this an event used to send the rest of the unused virgins home, or was it just a way of speeding them all into the harem? We're not really told. But there is Mordecai. He's busy at his day job. We know this because it's indicated in that statement that he was in the city gates. That's where the business of the ancient world took place. This was the typical place where legal and civic business happened. And archaeologists have actually uncovered the exact building where Mordecai would have been. It's a room attached to the city gates, which is 131 by 92 feet. One day while at work, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were part of the guard, decided they wanted to kill Ahasuerus. Again, the question why? We don't really know. We could speculate. had they fallen in love with some of the young girls? Were some of their sisters taken into the coal? Were they incensed by the way that the king just treated people? Maybe they were on duty and they heard something's going on. Were they hired to do the job? We're just not told. But Mordecai comes to hear of the plot. This is another detail we're not told. Did they approach him directly and try and involve him? Did he overhear it and they didn't really care if he overheard it? Because after all, the king had stolen Esther from him. You know, maybe he would even be sympathetic to the whole thing. These are all the details we don't have. But Mordecai comes to hear of the plot. Now, let's stop and imagine being Mordecai for a moment. What would you do if you knew that the king who stole Esther from you, a very wicked man, was about to be killed? Would you be a Bonhoeffer and be part of the suitcase plot to take out this terrible man? Or would you do what Mordecai does? And I believe that Mordecai did the right thing and sought to preserve the king's life. Because God is our judge. We are not the judge. We must do good to all, even to the evil. Instead of going through the regular channels for reporting these things, Mordecai goes straight to Esther, maybe to gain favor for her, or maybe because he just didn't trust someone else taking the credit. We see it all works out. The matter is investigated. The men are found guilty. They are put to death. It's all written in a book. Now let's just stop and ponder what should happen next. What should happen to Mordecai next? He should get a reward, right? He should get a promotion, right? Good. Let's read 3 verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. Doesn't feel good, does it? You can see where the story just went in the wrong direction. The expected blessing did not come. The wrong person got rewarded. The right person did not get the reward. Just where you would expect the promotion of Mordecai, it is Haman, the Agagite, who gets promoted. And he is promoted to a Joseph-like role, basically second in the kingdom. The name Haman means wrath, and he lives up to his name in this chapter. We are told that he's an Agagite. Now, this could be one of two things. It could literally mean that he is a descendant of King Agag, the king of the Amalekites. From 1 Samuel chapter 15. So we know of this infamous Agag, who is of the people of the Amalekites. Why is that significant? You'll remember that this was the king that Saul failed to put to death, and Samuel ended up doing the job for him. But the Amalekites are important because the Amalekites were the first people to attack the children of Israel as they were moving to take the promised land in Exodus chapter 17. You remember that event where there was a battle where Moses is on top of the hill. Aaron and Hur are holding up his hands, and as long as he holds up his hand, Joseph, who's down in the valley, will win the battle. The battle was against the Amalekites, and the Lord gave them the victory. And in Exodus 17, verse 15 and 16, it reads this. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." So here is this conflict, historic conflict, a generational conflict between the Amalekites and the people of God. But Agagite could also mean something else. In the first century, the Jews used to refer to the Romans as Agagites. And that would be basically anyone who was an enemy of the people of God. So it could have a metaphorical use. So you can take your pick. They both indicate the same thing. Enemy of God. Let's read verses 2 to 6. Now that we have Haman and Mordecai orbiting around each other, what happens next? And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. There he is, living up to his name. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So we come to a situation where Haman demands honor and Mordecai refuses to give it. It's by the king's command that Haman should be honored, but Mordecai still will not. Is Mordecai doing something good or something bad in refusing to pay homage to Haman? We don't know. It's descriptive, not prescriptive. It's possible we could say, well, he's probably doing the wrong thing. So, but why didn't he bow? Was it perhaps because Mordecai was angry that he didn't get the promotion and has personal resentment? Was there a past conflict between these two men who both worked in the courts? Was it a racial thing that he felt that a Jew could never pay homage to non-Jews? Did Mordecai perhaps think that this was a religious act? That maybe he was giving some form of worship to Haman? Well, that can't be true either. In fact, according to the New Testament, we are to give honor to whom honor is due. And that doesn't mean only those who have deserved it, but to the just and the unjust alike. Now, we must note Mordecai was not advertising his refusal to bow. In fact, it looks like Haman didn't even know it was going on until he was dobbed in by someone else. So Mordecai should not be mistaken for some sort of revolutionary casting a mold for government resistance. That's definitely not what we're seeing going on here. But his lack of respect kicks a hornet's nest, and Haman completely overreacts. He wants blood for disrespect. The second most powerful person in the country wants to be honored. Mordecai refused to give it. And now he not only wants Mordecai dead, he wants his family dead, he wants his whole people dead. And there is narcissism for you, if ever we have seen it. But let's just pause here. There are various lessons that stand out for us as we reflect on this. Firstly, why we do good and who we do it to. Why we do good and who we do it to. Mordecai did not use the attempt on the king's life for personal revenge. Nor did he receive his reward, at least not yet. Friends, we are believers who are called to do good to all. This will be hard. Firstly, because the good we think we should do, like stand up for the unborn, or refuse to use people's preferred pronouns, or if we're sharing the gospel in evangelism, or insist that gay marriage is not real marriage, these sorts of good deeds that we know are good and we know are even gifts to societies are not accepted as good. So we have an added problem there, don't we? They're not welcome. But our good deeds are seen by God as good. And perhaps we will even go unappreciated until judgment day. We must remember that we serve to please God, not man, reward in this life or not. In a fallen world full of sinners and injustice, we will not necessarily be acknowledged. This is our lot. This is okay, because God sees. And so it shouldn't impact upon our faithfulness. As Christians, we have the ultimate example set for us by Christ. He taught us to love our enemies. And this is exactly what he did in dying on the cross to save us. We were deserving of nothing but judgment, and he chose to give us mercy and not justice. He chose to give it all at his own expense. And Paul applies similar teaching in Romans 12, verse 17 to 21, when he writes, "Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." But there's another aspect here. God is in this. Why was Mordecai overlooked for reward? Because God is in control. God is in control. This is not God dropping the ball. This is not God's forgetfulness. This is God deliberately working out his good purposes. Because what will result from Mordecai being overlooked at this point? The king won't be able to sleep, and, oh, he'll have that record read to him, and he'll say, "Oh, what's happened to Mordecai?" And that will set the stage for Haman falling, not the people of God. And so all of this will be overturned later on to the glory of God, for the preservation of God's people and the punishing of God's enemies. So what about your situation? Are you in a situation that feels very unfair right now? You've done the right thing, and the good is not coming to you like you hoped. Is God in control? He always is. So then what is our duty? Stay faithful. Trust in God. As with Paul. As with Joseph. As with Mordecai. God is in it for our good. So how do we face these disappointments? Do we decide that God is weak, that he has failed us, that he is no longer reliable, and we now need to take matters into our own hands? No, we truck on in faith. Mordecai did not know how it was going to end, and in terms of our own situation, nor do we. What we do know is that these oversights were part of God's plan. And he is good, even though it doesn't feel good right now. Secondly, we not only see no good deed going unpunished, but even the smallest misdeed being overpunished. Mordecai refused to bow, and instead of just getting a slap on the wrist, what was the response? Genocide! Overkill. If it's not the justice of our good deeds not being recognized, then it will be the injustice of our misdeeds being overpunished and milked by the word as an excuse to exterminate us. Just think on Mordecai and Esther's sins for a moment. What was the one thing they've done so far? So besides the fact that she's agreed to become part of a harem, they have not revealed their racial identity. If Esther had just said, "I'm a Jew," what could not have happened at this point? Haman could never have even started getting his plan off the ground. Couldn't have happened. If only she had said, "I'm a Jew." She was the new favorite queen. That this court official would not even dare to plot against the Jews. But of course, God has a plan in all of these things. If only Mordecai had given honor to whom honor was due. If you speak to the president or the prime minister of any country, do you have to speak with them with respect? If you speak to a police officer, do you have to speak to them with respect? Yes, you do. When you speak to your parents, do you have to speak to them with respect? Yes, you do. You give honor to whom honor is due. If only Mordecai had just given a bit of honor and just done what was completely acceptable within the bounds of the law. But sometimes this is us, isn't it? We blow it. And our sins cause trouble. And we break things. And we can't control the collateral damage. And it spins way out of control. Who's in control of those situations? Is God still in control of those situations? Yes. Does he approve of the sin? No. But is God sovereign even over the collateral damage and the fallout of sin? This is one of the things we affirmed when we looked through the confession. And this is where we see it applied in the scriptures. Well, here's an example of it illustrated in the scriptures. God is in control and his grace and sovereignty are still at work even when we blow it and things go wildfire on us. Are you sitting with the wreck of some past decisions? God is still your God. You are still his child. He has not abandoned you. Even though you may be feeling some of the consequences, even though some of the things you may be feeling are discipline, he is for you. And he likewise will work this together for good. But let's look at Haman hatching a plot. Look at verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur. That is, they cast lots before Haman day after day. And they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So what we're doing as we move into this new section is we're looking at Haman plan his genocide. He plans his genocide. Esther has been queen for about 5 years. And as we begin, Haman is covering all of his bases. And what he does is he takes out divine insurance. And he gets some divination done. He calls in some people to cast some lots so that he can find the most propitious date to put the people of God under. And we see that he uses the pur. The Hebrew plural of this Akkadian word is Purim, from which we get the Feast of Purim. Okay? So this is where the feast comes from. Now, you and I are already triggering on the mention of the lots, aren't we? When you hear the word lots, your mind should automatically go to Proverbs 16, verse 33, which reads, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." Okay, now you know why they called it the Feast of the Lots. It's because this is an indirect statement of saying God is sovereign. There are no random events. Even the hairs that fall from our head are known by God. But there's another detail that comes to us from the text. The month of Nisan, the first month of the Jewish calendar, the month of Passover. What happened at Passover? What's Passover all about? Pharaoh had the people of God, and God delivered his people out of Egypt through the 10th plague of the Passover. So there is a question mark that begins to arise now. Will God deliver his people again? Is God the God of not only the people who dwell in the land, who went back to the land when they should have, but now even the people of the dispersion, even these exiles not in the land? So with the date chosen, and basically almost a whole year later, so they've got a whole year to prepare, and the apparent divine blessing for a propitious date, Haman sets his plan into motion. Look at verses 8 to 11. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws. So that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, The money is given to you, the people also to do with them as it seems good to you. This picture is familiar, isn't it? The enemy of the people of God is in power. The people of God are in his crosshairs. The people of God are slandered and misrepresented. They are set up as public enemy number one. Some form of unjust act takes place to bring persecution to bear. And in this instance, we see that Haman, through bribery, offers to pay an amount that basically 10,000 talents. So the annual income from taxes at this time was 14,000 talents. He's basically saying, I'll give you 2/3 of an annual tax revenue as a bribe, as an incentive. This is a man who's just fought a very expensive war and lost. He needs to refill the treasury. Quick. And here is someone offering him 10,000 talents. Now, a bribe buying death with silver. What does this remind you of? It is likely that the money would have been paid out of the plunder that is encouraged. You can see the plunder being encouraged in 3 verse 13. And Ahasuerus, we've mentioned this many times, not a good king, ever the terrible king. He is not the protector of his subjects. He is not a judge just who judges justly. He is indifferent. He allows himself to be bought off. He is not impartial. The king surrenders his authority on the spot, it seems. He didn't even sleep on it. He just said, oh, here you go. Surrenders his authority to be appropriated for the destruction of the people of God. The most powerful king at the time is an instrument of destruction against the people of God. People of God could not be in a worse place at a worse time. So the order is given and the details follow. Look at verses 12 to 15. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the peoples, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. So, the date is very important here, isn't it? The 13th day of the first month. Why is that date important? That is the eve of Passover. On the very eve of Passover, the edict was given. Haman makes his plans and publishes them on this very evening. He seduces the masses to get involved by offering them plunder. He calls for a complete genocide of men, women, and children. And the text ends with an understandable and often experienced reality, confusion. Now, we know how it's all going to go, but we need to apply this to our own situation. The book of Revelation sketches the experience of the New Testament church in the same terms as we see them here. Satan is pulling the strings of government power to bring the collective weight of the administration to bear to wipe out the people of God. Through the restraining grace of God, he is hindered. One day, the devil will be loosed, and he'll be able to rally all of that power, but to finally be destroyed. Like with Mordecai and the Jews, we as the people of God are slandered. We are misrepresented. We are seen as public enemy number one. And like Mordecai and the Jews, like sheep for the slaughter, our response is not one of starting a revolution, but of faithful trust. We're a part of the war of the ages, and we will experience times like these where we are caught in the crosshairs of satanic attack. We should not be surprised. We should not be anxious. Because we know how all things will end. In fact, we can know more certainly than Mordecai. Let's just think about Mordecai's level of certainty and what was his warrant for certainty. at the time. He was an exile, not in the land. That's the first count against him. Okay, he's not in the land. So, ooh, does God still bless me even though everyone went back and I'm still here? Not sure. He had not been the best obeyer of God's law. You know, he had encouraged Esther to go into a harem. He had told her not to reveal her identity as a Jew. He hadn't honored a city official as he ought to have done. Do you think God's going to bless him? Is he worthy of blessing? How do you think he feels? Probably doesn't feel very confident that he is deserving of blessing right now. And were God's promises still true for Mordecai and those who had not returned? They really would have been confused. They would have had less grounds for assurance that God would work all things together for good. But what is our standing? What is our warrant for assurance? You and I, as the blood-bought New Covenant people of God. We, on the other hand, have Christ. He has defeated Satan. He has paid for all of our sin debt by dying on the cross. He's broken death by his resurrection. He's begun the new age and given us the Holy Spirit as a down payment and guarantee of our inheritance. One day he will banish all the things that are in contradiction to his rule. And of course we remember that he too was sold for silver and yet remains undefeated. And so we see that God is for his people. He is a faithful God. He is a covenant-keeping God who continues to work together for good. And in fact, he makes us more than conquerors as a result of his faithfulness. So when we find ourselves in a similar situation, as we will as the people of God, this is our confidence as well. Let's pray.